Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 12-819, Narayan v. The Ritz-Carlton Development Company. Arguing for the petitioner, Judith Ann Pavey. Also appearing for the petitioner, Andrew J. Lautenbach. Arguing for the respondent, Lex R. Smith. Also appearing for the respondent, Joseph A. Stewart. Argument on the merits.
Good morning to all our counsel. Are you both ready to proceed today? Yeah. Ms. Pavey, my understanding, Ms. Pavey, is you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, correct? So we'll have the light go on with 10 minutes to go, give you a warning, and Mr. Smith will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. So please proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is not a commercial arbitration contract between two business entities of equal bargaining power. It's a consumer contract, and it's expressly governed by HRS 514A. The developer's arbitration clause in the declaration that Ritz-Carlton seeks to enforce is on its face grossly unconscionable. And to paraphrase Justice Acoba in the Waikoloa Beach Villa case, the arbitration clause was specifically designed to gain an unfair advantage by the developer over the purchasers, and 514A was meant to prevent exactly this type of abuse. This arbitration clause deprives consumers of judicial review. It has a one-year statute of limitations, even for fraud claims. Hawaii's statute is 6 years. It is secret, so the public is kept in the dark, and this is a public interest, consumer-oriented statute. It requires consumers to pay their own costs and fees. It deprives consumers of any meaningful discovery, and it wipes out totally consequential and punitive damages, insulating the developer from accountability for its own fraud, which is exactly what 514A was designed to prevent. There's no question that in this arbitration clause, the developer is seeking to gain an unfair advantage, and we believe that this unconscionable clause clearly violates 514A.
Ms. Pavey, what do you need to show in order to establish that the clause is unconscionable? What would the test be? You pointed out some aspects of the clause that you believe are one-sided in favor of the developer. What would the test be that would be applicable, and how have your clients met that test in your view?
Well, for the contract of adhesion, the Potter case states that if the contract is a result of coercive bargaining strength and unfairly limits the obligations and liabilities or provides an otherwise unfair advantage to the stronger party, then it is effectively unconscionable. I think there is case law on each of the aspects of this arbitration clause that I mentioned that holds those particular provisions are unconscionable, and they all have to do with the developer trying to take unfair advantage of the particular.
Does there need to be an element of unfair surprise, or is it, you know, in some instances or some formulations of our unconscionability test, we talk about procedural and substantive unconscionability, and in procedural context, we typically talk about unfair surprise. Does that requirement drop out in a case of a contract of adhesion, or does a contract of adhesion somehow satisfy that requirement, or are they two different tests between a contract of adhesion versus an unconscionable contract?
They're not entirely two different tests, but they do merge, and the more substantively unconscionable a clause in, the less procedural unconscionability you have to show. And I think that's really important in this case because this arbitration clause is so substantively unconscionable that we should not be required to show that much procedural unconscionability. But to the extent that we are required to show that, this arbitration clause is stuck in a declaration, and I'd like to refer the court to 514A, section 11, that talks about the contents of a declaration. If you read that statute, there are 13 aspects to it. Not one of those mentions an arbitration clause being in the declaration. The public report that was certified by this developer as true, accurate, and complete describes the declaration. There is no mention in the public report of the declaration contained in the arbitration clause. So you've got this draconian arbitration clause stuck on page 34 of a 50-some-odd page declaration. When you read what a declaration is supposed to say, doesn't have anything to do with dispute resolution. I'm not saying that you couldn't conceivably put an arbitration clause in a declaration, but under 514A-11, it states that any further details in connection with the property that the developer wants to include has to be, and I'm quoting, consistent with this chapter. So in order for an arbitration clause to be consistent with 514A, all you have to do is look at 514A section 121, where the legislature has described what an arbitration under 514A would look like. And it is the exact opposite of the arbitration described in this clause.
That clause you just read, doesn't it actually say any further details in connection with the property? It doesn't actually say anything to do with the transaction. I mean, it's like two steps removed.
You're exactly right, Judge, and I think we made that argument. It's true. We don't think a declaration or that this arbitration clause or that I should say the claims in this particular case have anything to do with the declaration. And that was another problem we had with the ICA opinion. It totally overread the scope of the declaration's arbitration clause. Was that your question?
Well, that's part of it, but the introductory clause, it says the declaration referred to shall express the following particulars. It doesn't say shall and including the following. I mean, it seems to say this is what's supposed to be in it, and it doesn't seem to encompass other provisions.
That's exactly right, and I think it is arguable that under 514A, a developer shouldn't even have an arbitration clause in a declaration, but because of section 10, subsection 10 under there, it's sort of an open catch-all phrase, but it does say, even in that one, that it has to be consistent with the chapter, and if you look at 514A 121, that describes what a fair arbitration would look like, and it's really important to know that under 514A, the arbitration clause, you always have judicial access because there is a trial de novo automatic for any arbitration under 514.11 or 514.121. And that section that stands for that proposition is 514A-127. So you are never precluded from judicial access under 514A. And it's very interesting to note, when you look at the purchase contract, it describes the documents relevant to a condominium project, and it includes the Hawaii administrative rules that go with 514A. And if you go down and punch in those web addresses, you will find a document that is published by the Real Estate Commission called Condominium Property Regimes, Owner's Rights and Responsibility. And there are four pages of that document that describe the different alternatives for dispute resolution for condominium disputes. And it specifically states in that document, any, I'm quoting, any condominium related dispute can be decided in court, which is exactly what 514A states. So to the extent that the arbitration clause in this declaration precludes you from enforcing your rights in court, it is absolutely unenforceable.
So I just want to be sure I understand. Any arbitration clause will be unenforceable, or only this one because of its actual provisions?
Clearly this one. Because of that catch-all subsection 10, I'm not prepared to argue that any declaration or that no declaration can have an arbitration clause in it. But 514A specifically states that if it does, it has to be consistent with 514A. And the arbitration clause that is in 514A, first of all, it applies the Hawaii arbitration statute. It doesn't take away any consumer rights. It gives you discovery under the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure. I mean, it is designed to, and it says right in the statute, provide substantial justice to all parties. It's an alternative form. Yes.
Ms. Baby, even assuming, well, just assume that there are parts of the clause that are unconscionable, does that mean necessarily that the clause has to fail?
Because this one is so unconscionable, the unconscionability infuses the entire arbitration clause. We don't think that it's capable of being rewritten. But frankly, Judge, 514A was designed to deter unscrupulous developers from purposely trying to take advantage of purchasers. That arbitration clause is clearly designed by a developer with that intent in mind. Not only does it violate 514A, but it violates its own public report. Its public report, when it describes the declaration, doesn't say anything about arbitration. It doesn't. It specifically says that under the declaration and the other documents, the purchaser's rights are intended to be, and in most cases are, enforceable in a court of law. So, to me anyway, this particular arbitration clause is purposely designed to undermine 514A and their own public report. And the public, I'm sorry, just
oh, I did have a question. It seems to, I don't seem to recall these arguments in your briefs, and I'm wondering if these are new arguments.
You know, they're not new arguments. They go to the lack of assent and they go to unconscionability. I think it is true that we didn't focus on them in our briefs. The ICA opinion was just so overbroad and overreaching. We never really had to go back to the basics before that. We didn't think it was necessary. But I do really think it is necessary because this is a 514A declaration, and that is the governing statute for any contract, any declaration having to do with a condominium. So
if we find just the arbitration clause unconscionable, are we able to just set aside the arbitration clause under the Federal Arbitration Act?
I think you are. Yeah.
Why would we not just knock out those parts of the arbitration clause that we might find to be unconscionable, assuming we did? There's a severability provision in the contract, so that would presumably indicate an intent by the parties that to try to save provisions that can be saved. How, in what sense is it infused with, you know, what would the test be to determine when something is infused with unconscionability as opposed to potentially being savable?
Can I first address your presumption about the intent of the parties, because one of our primary arguments is that that cannot be presumed under the facts of this case, and in fact just the opposite is true, because in the public report, which is required to be true, accurate, and complete, and it can't contain any misleading information, and if there is, and they can't omit any information that would make the documents otherwise misleading, they say that the purchaser's rights are intended to be, and in most cases are enforceable in a court of law, and the purchase contract itself confers jurisdiction on the Second Circuit, and as I just pointed out before, 514A, of course, provides judicial access for dispute resolutions in all condominium disputes.
Well, I was just talking about the severability clause.
Back to that point. I mean, the law allows a court to strike unconscionable provisions. There's no question about that. It's just that there are so many of them in this case, and to me, it indicates a bad intent on the part of the developer, and they shouldn't have the benefit of this court striking the ones that are just especially bad. That whole arbitration clause should be out of there. And the developer of all parties should know that they're bound by 514A. Their public report admits it. It states specifically that this condominium project and this document is bound by 514A. And I would like to point out also on the assent issue that we just briefly discussed, that the developer is the only signatory to that document. The parties that are here before you on the management-related issues, by the way, which are bylaw issues, never signed that declaration. So when you get to the analysis of assent, that is one important point.
But is it your position the severability clause then is not enforceable? Because that's what I was asking about. In other words, there's a severability clause in this declaration. I'm trying to get your position on what the effect of that is. And is it your position that it's unenforceable or irrelevant because not signed by the parties here or something else?
I would say yes, it is our position that it is unenforceable. I know there is law that allows you to strike certain portions, but under the circumstances of this case, yes, I would agree that it's unenforceable.
Why are we really, as you mentioned, the parties, the opposing parties here appear to be the management-related
That's right.
companies. So why... are we really dealing with the arbitration clause in the declaration or the arbitration clause in the bylaws?
Well, the only arbitration clause before the court is the arbitration clause in the declaration. And interestingly, the developer didn't even move to compel arbitration, and none of the other defendants did either. It was these defendants.
And they moved based on the declaration
strictly
arbitration.
On the declaration.
Not on the bylaws arbitration.
Not on the bylaws.
So if we look at the declaration arbitration provision, and it does generally say under the rules of the American Arbitration Association. So under those rules, a purchaser, a consumer, would be required to pay the cost of the single arbitrator, correct?
You know, the American Arbitration Association has so many different rules that we've found out about in connection with this case. I'm not really sure what the payment.
So if we were to strike if we were to find certain portions of the declaration arbitration clause unconscionable and unenforceable, then we would be trying to ascertain what the arbitration would look like under the AAA rules. How would we be fashioning what the arbitration rule, how would this arbitration be governed if we struck certain portions of this arbitration clause? You're saying that there are different rules even under the AAA?
Well, I can't honestly stand here and tell you, Judge, that I'm familiar with all of the AAA rules regarding arbitration of condo disputes, and I know there are a lot of them. But I can tell you that it was going to cost us $21,000 just to file this case with the AAA and get it set for a hearing.
So if a consumer, if a purchaser had a dispute with a developer, that's what it would cost for that purchaser to even initiate an arbitration?
That's what it would cost for this particular case.
I see. Okay.
Ms. Pavey, you talked about the public report, and I have a twofold question. One, you indicated that the public report requires that the important facts can't be omitted, and I want to ask you what places that requirement on the public report. And secondarily, and kind of most important, what does it matter if they violated the public report? How does that affect this particular case and the arbitration clause?
The public report is required under 514A of the developer. And the law specifically requires that the public report be true, complete, and accurate, not omit any material facts, and not misrepresent any material facts. And in the public report, on page 21 of it, the developer actually certifies that all of the information contained in this report is true, complete, and correct. That's on page 21.
And so how does that
in the description of the documents that are related to the purchase, on the front of the purchase agreement, the public report is one of those documents. It is considered part of the contract formation for the purchaser.
Can I ask you, it seems to, when you look at the purchase agreement, what it says is that the apartment shall be sold in accordance with and subject to all the applicable limited warranty terms, and then it lists all the documents.
That's
and
right.
Then it lists the declaration. So you go to the declaration, it has an ADR, an arbitration, and then it also lists the public report, which is integrated as well, and you look at the public report, and what the public report says, it seems to supersede actually the declaration, because what it says is the Condominium Property Act, the declaration bylaws control the rights and obligations of the apartment owners with respect to the project. And then it says the provisions of these documents talking about the declaration are intended to be, in most cases, are enforceable in the court of law. So
exactly.
It's almost as if the public report trumps the provision in the declaration.
Well, that is exactly right, Judge. And the reason that is true is because 514A trumps the declaration, and 514A provides judicial access under any condominium dispute. You have alternatives, and you can even go through an arbitration. But you get a trial de novo under the 514A. You always get judicial access under 514A.
I can't understand how a purchaser could be looking at these four or five different documents and figuring out which provision controls.
I couldn't agree with you more, Judge, but I will say that in the purchase contract, which is the document that most purchasers would be most interested in, it says the Second Circuit Court has jurisdiction of any dispute. So I agree with you. I think I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Davey. Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, my name is Lex Smith. I'm here on behalf of the appellants. Joe Stewart is with me. My clients, Mark Nagel and Mike Martinez, are here in the audience for this argument today. I would first like to ask that the court keep in mind the two questions that the law says are required to be considered by the court. Is there an agreement, and does the dispute fall within the scope of that agreement? I think it oftentimes, in this case, we tend to wander on to other arguments and other things, and I think it would be helpful if we could focus on those issues. I'd like to talk about the declaration for just a couple of minutes. The declaration creates the association. It puts the association in charge of administration of the project. It sets the standard by which the association is to maintain the property. It identifies the managing agent and identifies the duties, or some of the duties at least, of the managing agent. And as we've discussed, it calls for ADR. The bylaws, I would submit to this court, the bylaws say nothing consistent with the declaration. The bylaws say they are trumped by the declaration. It says if there is any inconsistency, the declaration controls.
How about the public report, Mr. Smith?
I can talk about the public report. The public report says, the language that's been cited in the public report is these provisions, the provisions of these documents are intended to be, and in most cases are, enforceable in a court of law. Arbitration clauses are enforceable in a court of law. Arbitration awards are enforceable in a court of law. There's nothing inconsistent with this language in the public report and enforcement of an arbitration agreement contained in the declaration. This report brings these other documents, highlights these other documents, and points out that they are important. Let me point out, these are $4 and $5 million transactions we're talking about. The number of documents that were provided in connection with a $4 to $5 million transaction is not excessive. These plaintiffs are sophisticated purchasers who well understand the importance of business documents and the importance of, if you don't understand it all yourself or if you're not reading it all yourself, you can get help. You get counsel, and you make sure you understand before you sign. So,
Do you think that saying that provisions of these documents are intended to be, and in most cases are enforceable in the court of law, is clear?
My view, Your Honor, yes. This document talks about, it identifies the other documents and says that the provisions of those documents are enforceable in a court of law. And as I say, arbitration agreements are enforced every day in courts of law, as are arbitration awards. And I would also point out that there are, the declaration itself, as the ICA noted, the declaration itself recognizes certain times when the parties would go straight to court. For example, one of the ways that that would happen would be if somebody is seeking injunctive relief before an arbitrator is appointed. Another way, the declaration in Article 9, I believe, says that, well, it has an entire procedure for collecting common area maintenance and for asserting liens against property, or against the units of owners that don't pay, and it provides that those liens are enforceable in the same manner that mortgages are enforceable. Again, I think that's a way that you might wind up in court instead. So, yeah, I do not, I would submit, Your Honor, there is nothing deceptive about saying that the provisions of these other documents are enforceable in a court of law.
I didn't mean in any way to say that if I was deceptive. No, I'm just wondering, it just seems so ambiguous, because if they are enforceable and they all have their own provisions, why say anything about it? It just creates a lot of confusion, because all of a sudden you're bringing up that these documents are intended to be enforceable in a court of law. And why would you have a provision if the documents already have provisions in them?
Well, the object is to, the law requires providing a public report in order to identify and help the purchaser understand. But you cannot repeat everything that's in all the other documents. So you try to provide a logical explanation that says these other documents are important and their provisions are enforceable, and courts will enforce them.
What's your response to the other side saying, declarations of purpose, the historical, when you look at the cases, they all talk about the whole purpose of these horizontal property scheme regimes to protect the consumer. Does it protect the consumer to have an ADR arbitration provision?
I would submit that it does, Your Honor. Arbitration is a speedy way to get a resolution of a dispute. Though it's not inherently unfair to consumers, it's not inherently unfair to developers.
You don't think it's inherently unfair to have a provision that totally takes away discovery unless it's agreed to by the other side? I mean, if this is to protect the consumer, and we have a provision in there that takes away the right to have discovery, and my experience with litigation, if one side has all the paperwork, it's certainly going to be tough to get a fair resolution.
I understand the criticism of the limitation on discovery. That's there in order to expedite resolution. However,
to which way to be expedited for whom?
Well, to get it over quickly, so for both sides. But what I would say is, first of all, the arbitrator has discretion to decide whether or not to enforce that provision, to decide whether or not that provision is lawful or enforceable. And furthermore, there's a savings clause right in the same section that says if any of these provisions are determined to be unenforceable, the rest of it survives.
I'm sorry, you're suggesting that the arbitrator could invalidate the restrictions in the declaration?
Indeed I am, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
It says the arbitrator shall have no other power to order discovery or depositions unless and then only to the extent that all parties otherwise agree in writing. So where does the arbitrator have that power?
It does say that, Your Honor. However, the arbitrator has, and the AAA rules provide that the arbitrator decides what the scope of his authority is.
So you're saying that there are other rules embedded in here that the purchaser would not know of?
What I'm saying, well, I'm saying that the agreement says what it says, which is that discovery is limited in the fashion that is contained in the declaration. But the arbitrator has the power to determine if certain provisions of the arbitration agreement are not enforceable or are contrary to law.
How does it advance the goal of consumer protection and certainty in these matters to have a provision that could be followed or not followed at the whim of the arbitrator? I mean, isn't the point to have certain clear rules and procedures spelled out for the parties to see and understand what they're agreeing to? So, I mean, it seems like that argument kind of undercuts your principal argument, which I take to be one of certainty and also that you believe your position is consistent with protecting consumers.
Certainly. That certainly is my position, Judge. Talking about the whim of the arbitrator, I think, as the precedents of this court indicate, the parties to an arbitration clause always take the risk of what the arbitrator is going to decide, whether the arbitrator may make a mistake or may do something incorrect. That certainly is a risk that's built into this arbitration clause and every arbitration clause. However, the arbitrator does have the power and to make the decision whether provisions in the arbitration agreement are enforceable or not.
It's just a minute. If there are certain provisions in the arbitration clause that are unconscionable, can they be stricken? And if they are, is the arbitrator just, or who's supposed to, are we supposed to just make it up as we go along as to what's going to be inserted into the, do we have an obligation or should we rewrite the whole agreement as to what should be the discovery procedures and other?
The court does not, this court certainly doesn't have, one, I believe the court has the power to excise portions of the provision if they determine they're unconscionable.
Sure, but put those in their place.
Okay. Two, if you excise the limitation on discovery, you merely excise it and let the arbitrator decide, again, what the scope of discovery is going to be. That would be true for, I mean, that's simple enough. The arbitrator has that power anyway, and that would be what I would expect would be the result if the court came to that conclusion.
What about the argument by Ms. Pavey that there are a number of unconscionable provisions and that unconscionability infuses the agreement to the point where the entire agreement would be or should be stricken? And I realize that you don't concede that any of the provisions are unconscionable, but what would be the relevant test to apply in that regard in terms of whether the entire agreement should survive or not if we were to find that some of the provisions were unconscionable?
Well, let me first point out that Ms. Pavey did not make that argument in her briefs. Even her argument about the limitations on remedies that are contained in the declaration are not in any of her briefs. So it may be improper for them to be brought up today before this court. As far as the court's question, though, again, if the court finds certain provisions of that arbitration clause unconscionable, it can strike them without striking the entire thing. And in fact, that's what's contemplated because there is language in the declaration that expressly says that. So
which rules of the AAA would then apply? Are there different rules for different types of arbitrations under the AAA? I think Ms. Pavey was referring to some sort of condominium dispute. But I'm wondering, I really don't know. Which rules would we say would then apply?
The AAA does have different rules, Your Honor, and they actually wrote to both of us and told us what rules they felt they had determined applied. I assume it's not the commercial arbitration rules. It's probably a real estate arbitration, but I don't really remember.
Mr. Smith? So what are the differences based on the different rules? Like who pays for what kind of discovery is allowed based on which rules apply?
I don't have it in front of me.
Is there a consumer arbitration provision in AAA? You know, I mean, yes, I understand that these are $4 or $5 million deals, I guess, but what about, you know, the regular 100? Are we going to allow developers to insert these types of arbitration clauses into all of the declarations and require consumers to pay for a single arbitrator or all? Arbitration can be very expensive for a regular person.
Agreed, Your Honor. Let me just submit, I don't think that case or that issue is before the court today. But as far as are we going to allow developers to insert arbitration provisions into condominium declarations, I think that is commonplace today. I think it would be a revolutionary change in the law.
Has this court ruled on this issue?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Have other state courts ruled on these issues?
On whether a condominium declaration can contain an arbitration clause?
An enforceable arbitration clause against consumers?
I assume they have, but that's not something that I've looked at.
May I ask you if, for example, this arbitration provision was stricken, wouldn't 514A-121 then be applicable? I mean, this case could end up in arbitration anyhow, is that right?
I don't believe the plaintiffs have a vision for this case to go to arbitration.
No, I understand that, but they would have to show the exception that's authorized in the statute. But nevertheless, that section that I cited would still be applicable, right?
514A still applies.
121, which says arbitration of disputes.
Your Honor, 514A-121 was not in my opponent's briefs, and I have to tell you that
it was. It was in a footnote in their reply. It is stated. It is referenced.
okay, in their reply to their cert petition.
Yes.
Okay, so the ICA did not have it in front of them.
I understand. We're not, I'm not asking you, that's not something we would have any authority to. I'm just asking you as a general matter, would you, if the arbitration provision was stricken, and I guess it's a theoretical question, but do you believe that provision might be applicable to this case?
I certainly agree that 514A applies, and I am not aware of any reason as I stand here now why any particular section of 514A would not apply.
You moved for arbitration under the declarations arbitration clause, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The bylaws do not contain an arbitration clause. The bylaws refer back to the declaration at every point.
What about Ms. Pavey's
argument? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Do I have the wrong? Okay, I thought that the bylaws were what was. Oh, it's the operating agreement. Okay, so you did you brought your motion under the declaration and the operating agreement.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
What about Ms. Pavey's argument that the arbitration clause in the declaration is inconsistent with 514A?
Your Honor, I would submit that it's not, that 514A allows for arbitration provisions, and in fact they are quite common. They are an efficient way for condominium associations to deal with disputes that come up regarding the management of the property.
I think she conceded or said that she was not arguing that all arbitration provisions would be improper under 514A, only that this one with the particular clauses that she's challenging would be. What would your response be to that point?
My response to that is that this arbitration provision is entirely consistent with 514A and, as I say, with the obligation to, or the desirability of obtaining expeditious, fair resolutions from a detached, neutral arbitrator.
What about the confidentiality provision? Could that potentially be read as prohibiting the parties from even contacting witnesses with regard to this matter to obtain information?
I certainly don't believe it would be read to prohibit contacting of witnesses. And again, I think an arbitrator would be called upon to enforce that in a rational way, which certainly wouldn't preclude talking to witnesses.
How does limiting punitive damages expedite the arbitration?
Again, Your Honor, the limitations on remedies were not raised by the plaintiffs in their prior briefing. Was not before the ICA. However, I think limitation on punitive damages, again, enables the parties to get to the point more quickly and to get a resolution rather than to make a major litigation and make attorney's fees and punitive damages a major aspect of the I do have a few more things to say. One thing I wanted to point out, this clause is expressly governed by the Federal Arbitration Act. There are numerous precedents under the Federal Arbitration Act. The ICA, I believe correctly, went to the precedents under the Federal Arbitration Act and applied them to reach the rule that is done. The rule that you apply state law general principles of contract interpretation while giving due regard to the federal policy in favor of arbitration by resolving ambiguities as to the scope of the arbitration in favor of arbitration. The rule that a forum selection clause in one agreement does not foreclose applying an arbitration clause in another agreement. The ICA cited cases, federal cases, for each of these rules. The rule that an arbitration should not be denied unless it may be said with positive assurance that the arbitration clause is not susceptible of an interpretation that covers the asserted dispute. So this is really where we are. We've got a case that's covered by federal law. Federal law calls for this case to be sent to arbitration. The plaintiffs have made some some objections to some very specific provisions of this arbitration clause. If the court doesn't like those provisions, they can be stricken without impacting, without any need to rewrite anything, and without impacting the enforceability of the balance of the arbitration clause.
Can I ask you what, I'd ask Ms. Pavey what she thought the test would be for finding a provision unconscionable. And you know, our cases do talk about procedural and substantive unconscionability, but there are, her argument, as I understood it, was that if you have what might be a contract of adhesion, that that would substitute for or satisfy the procedural unconscionability prong of that test. Would you agree with that? And if not, what would your formulation of the appropriate test be?
What I would say, Your Honor, is that there is no, that this is not a procedurally unconscionable transaction. There are countless luxury condominium projects on Maui. There are, the plaintiffs, the buyers, have the choice of whatever condominium project they want to go to. They have genuine, real choice in that regard. There certainly is no surprise or a procedural problem that way, because these people, first of all, they got all the documents, and secondly, they had a rescission period. The law requires that they be given a rescission period, so even after they got the documents and after they signed, they had a period that they could go review them, have their lawyer review them, consider them, anything they wanted, and elect to get out of it at that point as well. So I don't, procedural unconscionability, in my view, Your Honor, just does not attach here.
So you're saying that, you seem to be saying that this is different because these are sophisticated buyers of a luxury condominium. So I'm wondering, where do you think we would draw the line? What would the purchase price be as to which a clause like this would be enforceable, as compared to, you know, the for example, the low-income condominiums that are now being sold?
And I'm not in a position to argue a case other than the one that we've got before us. I'm not sure. When I was talking about the scope of this transaction or of each of these transactions, it was more to the point that the size of the stack of documents that they got is consistent with and reasonable in terms of a transaction of that magnitude.
Well, I mean, even in a regular condo, there's a pretty big stack of documents, right?
But I guess that's what I'm saying is that if somebody, I think whenever you're buying real estate, you need to make sure you understand what's in those documents. And that's it. Either read them yourself, take them to somebody, and get help. And so I don't know that that really makes a big difference whether it's a big transaction or a small transaction.
Okay.
Now, is this, in your view, my understanding, if I understand the plaintiff's position, is that this is a contract of adhesion because, in essence, there was no negotiation over the terms. The buyers were presented with these particular packages of a package of documents and either agreed or couldn't or didn't agree. And that would be sufficient to make this a contract of adhesion, and if so, that would satisfy the procedural unconscionability requirement. Or would you agree with that?
No, Your Honor. Under the precedence of this court, I think it's clear that the circumstances that the buyer is faced with have to be something that leaves them with no choice. In this case, as I said earlier, the buyer has choices.
Well, we have not required no choice in applying unconscionability in different types of transactions.
In procedural unconscionability, Your Honor, my understanding is, and the ICA seem to say the same thing, that where people have choices, you're not forcing something on them, they're not deprived of a choice.
Don't people always have choices? I mean, they don't have to park in a particular parking lot. They don't have to buy a particular. So does that rule not prove too much, as you've articulated it?
Your Honor, I think there are many cases where a buyer is left with no realistic choice other than to accept the terms that they're given to them, whether that's because you have the only parking lot within a mile or 5 miles, or for whatever other circumstance And the other point about this is there was a rescission period here.
So you seem to be arguing that the purchasers had a choice. So if we validate this arbitration clause, this means that every condominium developer could now insert this arbitration clause. Where would then the choice be for purchasers?
Your Honor, I think virtually every condominium developer already inserts an arbitration clause at least comparable to this.
Well, doesn't that answer your argument then that this, that in fact you've just proven that it's adhesion? You have no choice, and especially so if it's a luxury one where you want Ritz-Carlton. I mean, in fact, I actually think that that shows its adhesion if it's in every.
Well, what I would submit there is that everybody has the opportunity to look at what provisions are called for by the other developers. And I did say virtually all others. I think if one was shopping for a project that did not have an arbitration clause, they might be able to find one.
By the way, have you been following the proposed amendment to the FAA to preclude these types of clauses in consumer contracts? Do you know what the status of that is?
No, I have not, Your Honor.
What do you think of the theory of the sliding scale, the more unconscionable the provisions, substantively, the less you have to show procedurally of unconscionability?
I have not seen that in the precedents from this court, Your Honor. I mean, I see a two-element requirement, procedural and substantive unconscionability, and I don't believe that's been met here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Ms. Pavey, your rebuttal.
I would just suggest that in determining unconscionability, that we look back to 514A, section 121, because that tells you what the legislature thinks is conscionable, and it clearly contradicts nearly every single provision of the declaration's arbitration clause in this case. So if you use the legislature's opinion about what a fair arbitration would look like and how substantial justice is supposed to be afforded to all parties, it's right in the statute.
Ms. Beatty, can you address Mr. Smith's argument that the public report order contains the reference to having availability to file an action in court, how that impacts the arbitration clause?
That argument actually was probably the biggest surprise to us about the ICA opinion was when they said, well, you do get judicial enforcement because you can go to court and the court has to affirm the arbitration award. Affirmance of an arbitration award has nothing to do with enforcing the rights under the contract. And when you go to court to, validate an arbitration award, the court can't even consider what the rights were under the contract or whether the arbitrator ruled correctly on any of the rights under the contract. So I think that is just a very weak and argument, and it clearly it doesn't comport with 514A in any event.
Now, Ms. Pavey, if I understand your argument, you, although you find a lot of things you believe are unconscionable in this particular agreement, you're not making the argument at this point that all arbitration agreements would be prohibited in condo declarations. Is that, do I understand your argument correctly?
I think maybe that will be up to you folks to decide that, because I think arguably under 514A you could find that. But my view is that clearly if you have an arbitration clause in a declaration, obviously it would be limited to the declaration for one thing, but it would have to comport with 514A's description of an arbitration. And all arbitrations under 514A end up with the trial de novo if you choose to seek access to the court. So under 514A, you are never denied access to the court. And I think that is so important in consumer-related contracts. In Justice Kagan's dissent in the Italian Colors case, she talks about the effective vindication rule and about how in consumer contracts where an arbitration clause prospectively denies, The effective vindication rule prevents enforcement of an arbitration clause that prospectively chokes off a plaintiff's ability to enforce statutory rights, especially statutes expressly intended by the legislature to protect the public interest. And I resent the implication that was in their brief, and Mr. Smith made it again today, that people who buy luxury condos aren't entitled to the statutory protections that everybody else in the state are entitled to. But more importantly, Justice McKenna, your point is exactly why we're so grateful that you accepted cert, because this ICA opinion would wipe out the rights of the thousands of Hawaii families who already live in condominiums. And look at what is being built in this state. I mean, how many thousands more Hawaii families are going to be living in condos? And if you allow a developer like these guys in this case to insert an arbitration clause like this into a declaration, hide it, misrepresent it in all their other documents, and then come into court and enforce it, it would just completely wipe out the consumer rights that the legislature intended by drafting an entire chapter to protect consumers from unscrupulous developers.
Well, what's your reaction? Go ahead.
Oh, can I just jump in? Thank you. I want to just ask a follow-up as to your misleading statements argument, the misleading statement in the developer's public report. Is there anything in 514A where the legislature specifies, explains, or contemplates a remedy for that type of misleading statement in the public report?
You know, there are some sort of remedies in 514A, but essentially it says right on the reports and in that law that it's up to the developer to follow the law. And the Real Estate Commission is not monitoring whether all their statements are true or not. So it's the developer's responsibility. It talks about self-enforcement, which leaves it up to us when they try to enforce something on a consumer that violates 514A. I could think of a lot of ways you could write something. Told me about one of the remedies in there, which is rescission, and rescission is something that we've asked for. But essentially, for enforcing your statutory rights and your rights under 514A, you really do have to go to court. And that's why 514A provides for court access.
Well, what about Mr. Smith's argument that the vast majority of condo declarations in the state contain arbitration provisions? What would the effect be of us invalidating, in effect, all of those provisions? Wouldn't that have potentially, disruptive effects in terms of the settled understandings of the different parties to those agreements? And, in fact, it could be owners who, in some instances, may be disadvantaged by that. If two owners, for example, have a dispute amongst themselves, that could be resolved via arbitration. Would that now be precluded from them in a way that they had not contemplated when they signed up?
Absolutely not, Judge. 514A sets out a process that is available to everybody who owns a condo. Anybody can arbitrate. If you look at that document I quoted to you earlier that the Real Estate Commission publishes, they encourage people to negotiate, to mediate, to arbitrate, and then, if you have to litigate.
In fact, 514A-121 says it's the default.
Exactly.
If the parties don't have an arbitration provision, 121 kicks in and it sends everybody to 658.
That's exactly right, Judge. And that is, they provided for that. And, you know, even if you struck every single arbitration clause in every contract, declaration, anything having to do with a condominium, you'd still have 514A. Because 514A governs condominium disputes and it provides for arbitration. So you're definitely not putting anybody in a bind or making arbitration unavailable to anyone. So, no. Just a couple of points in response to a couple of the arguments that Mr. Smith made. He said, in terms of looking at the unconscionability of the specific clause, if the court doesn't like a particular provision, you can strike it. This is not a question of what the court does or doesn't like. This statute tells the court what is unconscionable. It tells the court what is not fair. You don't have to just kind of willy-nilly look at it and say, oh, you know, do we want to find that that is unconscionable or this clause is unconscionable? This statute basically tells you what the legislature considered unconscionable.
Ms. Pavey, would you address Mr. Smith's argument that that we can strike the unconscionable parts and leave it to the arbitrator to determine what procedure to follow after that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is so contrary to the purpose and intent of 514A. Essentially, what that does is substitute some unknown arbitrator for the judgment of the legislature, and the express provision in 514A that people have access to our courts for the enforcement of our laws. So I totally disagree with him.
That provision, in fact, certain times in the ADR provision, sometimes it says the AAA rules will apply or if there's disagreement, but at least as to the discovery, there's no reference to the AAA rules. And if, you know, Mr. Smith, I understand it, if there is something in the AAA rules that say that the arbitrator has that kind of authority, it doesn't seem to be stated here.
That's right, and that goes to the two arguments that we made below, contrary to Mr. Smith's statement that we didn't argue unconscionability below. Of course we did, that and lack of assent. And your point, I think, Justice Pollack, goes to the ambiguity in what they're trying to achieve here, and in our law and state contract law on how to deal with ambiguity in contracts favors us. Ambiguity is construed against the drafter. So if you look at those kinds of questions and you can't figure out what really is going to be arbitrated, what rights really will be enforceable, those ambiguities should be construed in favor of the consumer, not in favor of the developer. Under 514A and Hawaii law.
How do you reconcile that, what you just said, with this broad scope with which we're supposed to interpret the arbitration provisions?
I'm sorry?
What you just argued, that in contract interpretation principles, mm-hmm. it should favor you folks. How does that fit with the broad scope with which courts are supposed to interpret and apply arbitration provisions?
Oh, I see. I understand your point. First of all, I think you're referring to the law under the Federal Arbitration Act about interpreting the clauses very broadly to basically encompass arbitration no matter what. That's not Hawaii law.
But here we have the arising under, right? And that's supposed to be very broad.
That's under the FAA. I think when you apply Hawaii state contract law to this arbitration clause, mm-hmm. that argument doesn't carry any weight. It doesn't even apply, quite frankly. Okay. And I would also like to say that there is a case on point in Hawaii. It's called the Association of Owners versus the City and County of Honolulu, I think, that specifically says that the judicial enforcement of 514A is supposed to be progressive and not restrictive. So it gave the green light to the court to really make 514A mean to the consumer what the legislature intended it to mean.
Thank you for your argument today, Ms. Pavey and Mr. Smith. The court will take this matter under advisement.